From the campus of Stanford University, this is Schools In.
They believe that what we're being told is everything they need to know, and they just pay attention to that.
You actually have to teach the teachers how to teach for innovation.
With your hosts, Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
Welcome to Schools In. I'm Denise Pope, senior lecturer with the Graduate School of Education here at Stanford, and I'm with my co-host, Dan Schwartz, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Education.
Hello, Denise Pope, BA, MA, PhD, any other higher education letters back there?
No, that's a lot of letters. That's enough. It took me many years to gain those letters.
So our show is about higher education today, and I wanted to start with some very bad sentence completion, figure out the analogy.
Okay.
So this is one where there is a right answer, but I'm the only one who believes it is the correct answer.
Okay. This ought to be fun.
Okay. So Jane Austen novels have something in common with the way people think about college.
Let me figure this out. Jane Austen novels, so Pride and Prejudice, have something in common with the way people figure out how to choose a college. Is this how to choose a college?
Okay, so this one was a little too hard.
Yeah, Dan, I don't have a clue where you're going.
So in Jane Austen novels, they all end when you get married.
Yes, as do most Shakespearean comedies. This is like the genre that we're talking about.
Just because I catch you unawares doesn't mean you have to show off your other sources of knowledge.
Okay, everyone ends getting married.
And that's the way people think about college. The goal is to get into college, and nobody talks about it beyond that.
Oh, damn.
So it wasn't so bad.
I like that.
Thank you. Although people are starting to question the value of college. You hear this. So I'm a parent who doesn't really think my kid should go to college. What's the argument you're going to make to me?
Okay, you are an extremely rare parent because the parents I meet are all trying to tell me, how can I get my kid in, particularly to Stanford? So you're a rare parent who says, I don't know if it's worth it. This is what I would say. I think that going to college is more than just learning certain skills and learning content. So I would say you should go to college or something like a college, right? Because there's that experience of moving out of your house, living on your own, taking responsibility for your own actions, being around other people with similar interests where you can, learn and get out of your bubble.
Not that I'll get a better job, get better pay.
Well, we do know that people who are college educated actually over their lifetime make more money than people who aren't. But I do think that things are changing so quickly in the world that, I don't know, we're going to have to ask our expert about that too.
Why is college like your mouth?
Oh my God. Tongue, teeth, lips. It's got lots of moving parts, and you put it all together and it sounds lovely.
That is very good. I think your answer is better than mine. College is like your mouth because your mouth does a lot of things. It chews, it talks, it kisses, it tastes. College is like that. It does a lot of things.
Oh, and four kids, more than just academics. So you're kind of agreeing with my overall point of why you should go to college, maybe.
Yes, I would. If we're off the air, I'll agree with you.
Oh, okay. You heard it here.
First.
So we are really lucky to have one of the world's expert historians with us. David Labrie is a professor here at Stanford Graduate School of Education. He teaches courses that students absolutely love on the history of school reform and the history of higher education in the United States, among a bunch of other topics. He is the author of many books, including two with my absolute favorite titles, How to Succeed in School Without Really Learning, and his more recent book, A Perfect Mess: The Unlikely Ascendancy of American Higher Education. David, thank you for being here.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
This is going to sound like a crazy question because I think people go to and think about colleges and they think, well, they've been here for hundreds of years and they've sort of always been here. But that can't be the case. We had to start somewhere, right? So how did we get this college system that we know today?
The American system is pretty young by world standards. The university in Europe is a medieval creation, and some of them are 1,200 years old.
So
ours are,
that's
ours
old.
Are young. I mean, Stanford is a little over 100 years old, and we think that's really cool, but really. I was just giving a talk at the University of Vienna, which was founded in 1365.
Wow. Is it a university in any way that we would recognize?
No, absolutely, completely.
Except for people like wore robes.
No robes. No robes.
Wait. Back then, it was the same thing. You went to class. You had a professor talking to you. Seriously?
Yes.
Kids napping in the back.
What? Really? My favorite part, though, was if you were a doctoral student in those days, your professor would present a paper, and your job was to defend your professor's
dissertation. So people probably don't know this, but in the real world today, it is not like that at all. The doctoral student presents the paper, and the professors try to throw darts at it, and your whole defense of your dissertation is defending this paper. So it was the opposite back then.
Well, professors were gods then. I wish I could have been there. Yeah, your students had to defend you. That was their entire job.
Oh, some people think you are a god, David.
Oh, yes.
It's true.
Yes.
One of my prize students, her goal in life is to prove me wrong.
That's good. It's a good goal.
Has it been hard?
You know, the 90th time you get a little tired of it. So say a little bit about sort of the uniqueness of how universities and colleges start in the U.S.
It was a very different kind of setting. The university started here before actually the revolution, the first universities came about. So it was in a setting where the state was very weak. There was no national church, as was the case in Europe, and the marketplace was very strong. So you ended up with a situation where the initial colleges started as not-for-profit corporations. They had a charter from government, just like a profit-making corporation has a charter. They'd come up with their own board of trustees. They'd go out and hire a president who'd hire some faculty, who'd recruit some students, put together a program, and you had a college. There was very little state money behind this. And since there was no one big church, there were a bunch of individual denominations, they would contribute a little bit to put their name on a college. But otherwise, they were out kind of hustling on their own. They had to get students to pay tuition, and they had to get local donors to kick in the money and provide a building and subsidize the whole enterprise.
So do we have more variety?
Huge variety.
Yeah.
And so what it means is that it was a very strange system from our point of view, and that it's a system without a plan. Nobody designed it. It's fiendishly complex. Nobody could have designed something as complex as this. So it's not the system in the sense that you usually think of it, like a political system where everything operates according to some constitution that people set up. It's a system more like the solar system that evolved over time. It has rules. It had a structure. But unless you're a strong believer in intelligent design, it didn't have a prime mover. It just kind of evolved.
Wow.
So it's an emergent system that kind of made it up as it went along.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with David Labrie, a professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Education, historian of higher education. I guess that's why you called the book A Perfect Mess.
Yes.
Are there other reasons why the system is a perfect mess?
Well, I think the interesting thing that happened to me as I was reading the book is that, and it goes back to something that Dan was saying at the beginning, one of the strengths of the system is its messiness. It's not streamlined. You look at an organization chart for a university, and it would drive a corporate leader insane. There are no direct lines. There are little things all over the place. There are dotted lines. There's no direct accountability. Things are highly decentralized. Nobody's in charge.
Is that true? Wait a minute.
Oh, wait. The dean's in charge.
No, that is true, particularly at a place like Stanford. Very decentralized, different units. Sort of, it's like the internet. Nobody really knows everything that's going on the internet.
Ooh.
There's no one person.
I think from an outside, well, I guess I'm an insider, but when I was a student at a university, I would think that the president had control, or the provost, which is a weird word that I didn't really know what it meant, but those two people seem to have the power in the university.
So David can correct me if I'm wrong on this. I don't think it's a question of authority. I think it's a question of, it's so much variability. It's sort of impossible to know it all.
Mm.
So, you know, you put in systems that hopefully have other people who know and can take care of stuff, but just think of so many people who are all trying to discover and innovate new things.
The American system, though, the president is actually a lot stronger than in most universities around the world. In a lot of European universities, the president is elected on an annual basis by the faculty.
So, oh, that would be a nightmare.
So that under those circumstances, it's somebody has no power at all. But the American model is, again, it started out as a corporation. And so the CEO is the one who hires everybody, who controls the budget. So university presidents, college presidents in the U.S. have, they don't feel like they have a lot of power, but compared to their counterparts, they do. And as our past president, John Hennessy, liked to say, people say that college administration is like herding cats. But he says presidents have some cat food that they can move around, and the cats will follow it. So they do have ways of doing things, but it's basically they have to create incentives. They can't give orders. That's a very different kind of power.
That is a different kind of power. And yet, in the book, you tell us that our higher ed system is actually pretty good. So how did this crazy decentralized perfect mess, is it good?
Just the marketplace?
Yes, basically. I mean, it was interesting because the 19th century, the messiness was the obvious thing, not the quality. There was not a lot of quality in the system in the 19th century. Europeans used to love to come to the U.S. and then write snarky letters back to people saying, they call this a college. Mm, come on.
They mocked us. Those Europeans, they mock us.
They were tiny institutions that were popping up all over the place, usually in the middle of nowhere. Have you ever noticed American colleges are scattered around the countryside? They deliberately were not set up in major urban centers, in
fact.
That's
fascinating.
And one reason was not very enlightened one, and that is that colleges were a primary mechanism for promoting land development. A way to sell your land was to set up a college in your little place that you called a town. And then you could claim that the land all around it was worth more than the town next door that didn't have a college there. We have a cultural center. They're just a dusty agricultural village. Hmm. So college communities were kind of like the golf course communities of today. If you had a lot of land, you might donate some right in the middle, build a building, set up a college, and then sell all the land around it as a premium.
As someone who has schlepped their kids around to visit colleges all over the U.S., I can attest that there are some colleges in very Boonieville places. And if you have a kid who doesn't want to be that far away from a city, they look at you, why are we driving here? There's like literally nothing here. We were excited that there was a Bed Bath & Beyond an hour and a half away. That was like a woohoo moment. So this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're speaking with David Labrie, a historian of higher education, professor here at the Stanford Graduate School of Education.
So given that this system has worked so well, there are movements to make colleges accountable, you know, to sort of have maybe standardized exit tests, things like that. Is that going to just ruin everything, or it's just never going to happen, or?
In a word, yes, it would ruin everything. And think it goes back to your question before, the things that made the system looked terrible in the 19th century. The fact it was so decentralized, it was so overbuilt. Just to give an example of how overbuilt it was, in 1880, the U.S. had over 800 colleges and universities, which was five times as many as in the entire continent of Europe, which is the place where they invented the university.
Oh, boy.
Ohio had twice as many universities as the United Kingdom did that had been in the business for 1,000 years. So
they just coalesced them all into one massive Ohio State?
Yeah. So, Ohio State, you know, University. So it was like an incredible amount of capacity. But what was turned out to be advantageous was that these are institutions that had to learn how to survive without steady funding, without a steady flow of money from the government in particular. And so they had to figure out how to attract students, how to maintain student loyalty to the institution so that they would send their kids there and make donations later on in life. They needed tuition. They needed to get in grant money. They needed to generate income any way they could. And it turns out that created an enterprise that was incredibly adaptive. Institutions could find whatever opportunity was out there and jump on it. where there is an incentive structure from top to bottom to go out and pursue those opportunities. And it's still very much the case. You look at the way a university works, the president's in charge, but in some ways every faculty member is an entrepreneur out there seeking research funding, pursuing a career, generating research projects, attracting students. It's like a whole collection of enterprises, and that's turned out to be a very powerful way of setting up an institution that's able to figure out answers to problems that people haven't come up with yet. If you planned it, you'd say, we have a 5-year plan. We need somebody to develop ideas about this, that, or the other thing, which we think is the coming thing. But what universities have been doing is generating huge amounts of capacity and then later on finding something useful to apply it to. And it turns out that's a really productive way of doing things.
Interesting.
It's like it's the difference between a planned economy and a market economy. There's some real advantages in kind of letting things happen and see what turns up, because chances are you're not going to be able to plan something as cool as will evolve on its own.
So a couple of misconceptions that people have about college, especially when they hear that I work at Stanford, they say, what do you mean you have to raise your own money? Doesn't Stanford just give you the money to do the research? I think that's a really common misconception out there that people don't understand. Faculty members need to raise their own research money, even if you're at a wealthy university. And then another thing that you said, which is fascinating, is that they need people to be loyal so that they can graduate and then give money back, right, or support it. So how do you get your students to be loyal?
Well, the colleges needed to develop that right away. And so they
Sports.
Football is king.
Wow.
Football is king. You have heard it. If you don't have a football team at your college, are you just a nothing? Nobody?
Close to it.
Oh,
My undergraduate had a football team, but I think it hadn't won a game in like 6 years.
But part of it is particularly the undergraduate experience is to make this not just a place where people go and they learn, but a place where they have a good time, where they develop a lot of social skills, where they end up meeting the person of the opposite sex they might want to marry someday, who comes from the same kind of background, where they pick up leadership skills by running a fraternity or being the captain of some team, and they develop a kind of identity with the school that's really quite unusual. I have a lot of contact with European universities, and students and faculty there don't identify with their institutions. They don't wear the colors.
They don't have sweatshirts say Oxford.
There's no logo.
There's no logo. That's key. I mean, because you talk to some of these people like Michigan or Ohio. I mean, you don't wear the – look, Berkeley, Stanford, take off that red shirt. I mean, people literally say that to me, take off that red shirt. It's crazy.
So I was working with some doctoral students from University of Bern in Switzerland. And so they came to the University of Wisconsin. If you want to go to a kind of a classic American university, go to the Big Ten. And they arrived in the fall, football season. And they got there and they said, this is really tacky. Everybody's wearing red. And they got W's on them. And they've got, what is it, Bucky? I forget what they're...
The Badgers.
Yes. They went to their first football game, and 2 weeks later, they were in the bookstore buying T-shirts, hats, sweatshirts. They still wear them. They paste it all over their computers.
So it's contagious.
It is.
It's contagious. All right. Well, this is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We will have more with David Labrie, professor at the Stanford Graduate School of Education, talking about the history of higher ed, talking about the history of colleges and universities in the United States and around the globe. Next on SiriusXM Insight 121.
Students focus on what they were told, not paying attention to the situation.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope.
So they're not going to see anything new because they're so busy trying to copy what you told them.
From the campus of Stanford University.
Welcome back to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We are talking today with David Labrie, professor here at the School of Education at Stanford, and he's a historian. Particularly today, we're talking about the history of higher education, colleges and universities. And Dan, you had a question about accountability.
People are concerned about accountability, say, for for-profit schools. Mm-hmm. The concern, is that people are spending money to go to school, and then if that school's not accountable, the money didn't get them anything, the school may close, bad education, and so on. And so that's accountability in the short run. But you think in the long run, making colleges accountable would be a bad thing?
Yeah, I mean, in the short run, it makes sense to say if you went heavily into debt to get this, they should be offering something that looks like a serious educational experience and that you have a chance to actually put it into practice. But the more broader sense of accountability has a number of problems around it. One of them is that it tends to radically simplify what a college or university is. They're fiendishly complex. And part of the complexity is that they're serving a point that Dan made earlier, lots of different purposes all at one time. And we tend to focus on like one or two of them. So one simple solution would be, let's just unpack the thing and let's just have one place that just provides undergraduate education. That's all the professors do. Be a lot cheaper, no football team, no research labs. Have another one that's like a research facility. That's all they do. And somebody that just does graduate education. But the thing that makes the whole system work is the interaction effects. It's bringing people together that can serve multiple purposes at the same time and where there are lots of interesting cross-subsidies going on that allow you to sustain that degree of effort you wouldn't if you just had to focus on one at a time.
Although what you just described, from my understanding, is what small liberal arts colleges do. They don't have graduate students, and they don't really have big rah-rah football teams, and they are focused on undergraduate education. So how do you jive that with what you just said about the importance of having the diversity?
Well, part of it is that they're in a complex system where they're playing a particular role. So liberal arts colleges don't have university apparatus, but in many ways they are a big pipeline straight into graduate schools. Mm. So it just means you're doing your undergraduate program somewhere else and then going to a university later for the graduate program. Again, the system is so complex that you can have different functions happening at different institutions, but the broader structure, it's necessary to have the kind of synergies I'm talking about. And particularly the big research university, it needs all the parts. I mean, one of the things we found out at the beginning of the 20th century is that the German research university model just didn't work here.
What was that?
It was
David?
One focused very heavily on graduate preparation and research and was not very interested at all in undergraduates. And so that just doesn't work in the U.S. It turns out that the undergraduate structure is what holds it all together. For one thing, undergraduates are the ones that really identify with the school. For an undergraduate in the U.S., your college is not just where you go, it's who you are. It's the identity you wear, and that's really important. And so you need that really strong base. I mean, once you have a bunch of undergraduates, it justifies hiring more faculty who can then do some of the research work, and they subsidize that by teaching large courses, and then their graduate students help out with those courses, which helps support them. And you have the kind of the weaving together of multiple roles in one place.
This is Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. We're talking with David Labery, a professor here at the Graduate School of Education and historian of higher education.
So why don't I just have an accountability system where every college says, our graduates make this much money on average, and then if it drops below a certain amount, we get rid of that college?
There are rankings, just so you know, there are rankings out there. Like,
I pay a lot of attention to those rankings.
Right? That rank literally what is considered return on investment and how much money your graduates are making.
Right. And so my proposal is if you have a school where the graduates aren't making enough money by some standard, then that school is no longer able to offer a credential.
That school is called an ed school because they don't make any money. So that's not going to work.
I take it back. So the context here is sort of trying to come up with a way to value college education that doesn't make it reduced to one dimension or another, because the feeling is if you do that, it's both dishonest to what the experience is, but then a bunch of schools and universities will start to twist to achieve that test metric, basically.
And then lose some of that marketplace benefit, right, that David was talking about.
Right. So the value will go down even though people will believe it's going up by some metric. And so it'll miss it. At the same time, there are people who are questioning the value of a college education. Is it our responsibility to stand up and protect the value of a college education? Or
it's a little, some ways, embarrassing. I'm on the insider, and I'm saying we're doing a great job. and give us more money.
You can back it up, though, David, right? Yeah. I mean, you think people should go to college?
Yes, I think it makes sense. And on the economic sense, it totally makes sense.
So while we're freewheeling, so it used to be that not everybody went to high school. We've done a pretty good job of getting everybody into high school and graduating, like 85% or so. Should everybody be going to college? Does the U.S. need to do this to stay competitive as jobs change?
Whether they need it or not is kind of irrelevant. The structure of our opportunity system is such that you can't avoid it unless you're making very selective choices about what you're going to do with your life. To get white-collar jobs of a certain quality now, if you don't have a college degree of some kind, you're not even considered.
But we could require it. I mean, we require people to go to high school. We could require them to go to college.
Many companies do, by the way. I have seen companies with ads that say college degree required.
And will that destroy the market system that has made colleges great if we make everybody go?
The structure is such that it's hard to avoid college. It provides a whole bunch of benefits, as you mentioned early on, that aren't a financial at all, but that are big benefits later on. Like, people are more likely to engage in political activity. They're more likely to vote. They're more likely to be following news. So this is a good thing.
So part of the problem, though, is we believe everybody should go to college. Until it's required, there won't be the financial resources put into it to guarantee that everybody gets to go to college.
I mean, I think, though, the problem that's bringing up the accountability issue is the fact that for middle-class families, it is required to go to college, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the issue. Now that college has become the norm, this is what most people are expected to do, it's now suddenly not the selective thing that you could do if you wanted to. Now it's suddenly right in the middle of the scope, and we start attacking it. I mean, it's the same role that the high school played in much of the 20th century, where everybody was going, and it was the target of, we need to fix it, we need accountability, we need to raise standards. But college was always they were the good guys, they were the model. And now, they're not the model anymore because they're the norm, they're the new high school.
And that's really an interesting analogy. I didn't know that about high schools, that when they became required. So, and normal, suddenly that's when the critique started.
Yeah, we stopped talking about high school graduates and started worrying about high school dropouts. And now we're worried about college dropouts. We've sort of flipped it around.
Yeah,
it's not something
really
you can do. It's something you need to finish.
And if we're going to have that, then they better be good. That's the thinking. All right. Well, so we're going to have you back to talk about how to actually make this work. You know,
he's a historian. That's not his job.
That's right. You're right. We'll ask someone else. David, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been terrific.
Thank you.
And thank you for listening to Schools In with Dan Schwartz and Denise Pope. If you missed any of this episode, listen anytime on demand with the SiriusXM app